Welcome to the Internal Revenue Service. You can also visit us at www.irs.gov.
Hello, and don't worry, you haven't just called the Inland Revenue Service. You're listening to Stephanomics, the podcast that brings the global economy to you. But if you were trying to get through to the hard-working folks who help to collect America's taxes, you'd have a long time to wait. Keep listening to hear about the extreme lengths that American taxpayers and accountants are going to get through to the IRS. First, though, I wanted to play you part of a webinar we held this week featuring the latest insights on the road ahead for the US economy, China, and the US Central Bank, featuring some of the brightest minds of Bloomberg Economics. It started, naturally enough, with a great introduction by me.
There does seem to be an unusually wide gap right now between where we are and where economists expect us to end up in a year or two's time. I mean, the leading assumption when you look at the forecast for 2023 or 2024 is that we're kind of heading back to normal in the global economy by that time, probably by mid-2023. And that's fine. That's a traditional assumption that economists make, sort of reversion to the mean. But you look around you and you think, wow, we're an awfully long way away from normal right now. You know, we've got a large chunk of the workforce isolating at home, maybe due to Omicron. We have energy bills soaring in large parts of Europe and for many American households, millions of workers missing from the labor market, supply chain still in a very troubled state. I mean, it all seems very out of whack. So although it's probably always the case that economists are better at telling you where you're going to end up and how you're going to get there, I think this year that path from A to B, from now to normal, seems particularly hazardous and uncertain. And I think the potential role of central banks in that also feels particularly challenging. So I'm especially glad that we're focusing today on the downside and upside risks that we're seeing in the global economy. And I'm also very glad that we're going to spend a bit of extra time talking about how the US Central Bank is positioned for this year with one of the former leaders of the Federal Reserve, the former New York Federal Reserve President, Bill Dudley. So that's all to come. But first, I think we should set the scene with our chief US economist, Anna Wong. Anna, how are things looking?
Thank you, Stephanie. So a big question heading into this year for us is, when will the Fed begin to raise rates? And a March rate hike had looked uncertain when we were just entering into this year because Omicron had swept through the US like wildfire and caused widespread workers' absenteeism. There were lots of anecdotes of temporary business closures. So we developed a daily GDP tracker to allow us to better track the disruption of Omicron. And it had pointed to a big plunge in activity in the first week of this year. And using this daily activity index as a tool, we forecast out what GDP would look like at the end of the quarter. And the model forecast, the recovery would be in full swing by March. And in a reassuring sign, indeed, our daily tracker is already showing signs of improvement in the second week of this year. So this is why we now believe that a March rate hike is in the cards. So then the next question is, how many hikes will there be this year? And the Fed futures market currently expect 4 hikes, but that forecast is contingent on inflation and unemployment rate evolving as we have written down. And our baseline currently is for inflation to peak in February at 7.2%. And thereafter, we expect it will slow to an average of 3%. In the labor market, we expect it to continue to show signs of being very tight. Wage growth is now at the highest since early 1980s. There's 1.6 open jobs for every unemployed person out there. And we project unemployment rate to fall to 3.5% or lower by the end of the second quarter. But let me emphasize that our forecast for the inflation is subject to a lot of uncertainty. And we see two non-trivial risks in the near term that could push it much higher. So first, with China hosting the Winter Olympics in early February, and for the first time really open its borders to international visitors, there could be a risk that Omicron will infiltrate into China, and with their zero COVID policy, this could disrupt the production there and re-intensify supply chains. And the second risk is that there is a risk of port strikes in June of this year in the, along the ports along the West Coast in US as the contract expires between the port workers, longshoremen, and the ports. So overall, we think that the risks are on the upside for more hikes in store than what the market currently expects, both for this year and next year.
Thank you, Anna. There's a lot there, but I'm interested in what you said about wage growth picking up and also the potential for us to hear from some union activity, or at least in those sort of crucial deals at the ports. And I think power workers have also got potentially a dispute coming down the track. I mean, are we going to see a very different kind of US labor market this year than we've seen in recent years? Or is this with workers actually able to extract real wage increases? Or is this really just about trying to catch up with a very high level of inflation?
I think that when the labor market is tight, as we are seeing right now, as I was saying, 1.6 open jobs for every unemployed person out there, just the threat of your workers quitting, it's that latent threat there that can cause employers to raise the wage and submit to request of the workers. And when it comes to the port workers, in historically, whenever there's when the port workers are up for renegotiating their wages, there has been significant slowdown in ports. It happened in 2012, it happened in 2014, 2015, and at a time when these port workers had been asked to work 24 hours per day by the Biden administration, I think they are fed up. And so the likelihood of that is high. But back to the, your question, I do think that the labor market now is different than what we have seen in the last 10 years, just because there is just this latent threat of quitting, which gives a lot of bargaining powers to workers.
Those missing workers we have, the several million workers who were, as far as we could tell, were in jobs before COVID struck and maybe lost their jobs during the recession but have not gone back. Is there any sign of some of those coming back into the picture?
Yeah, so we had estimated how much workers have in their bank by income deciles. And our expectation is that the workers which are in shortage, their savings give them enough about two months of runway to cover their spending. And we were expecting that there would be a flood of labor supply starting this year because of that estimate. And I do see signs of the labor market loosening, but that was right before Omicron hit.
Okay, so we've got a good picture on the state of the economy insofar as we can see it, and we can see it a bit better with those high-frequency indicators. But clearly, the center of a lot of the debate, and certainly what financial markets are focused on, is what's the Fed going to do? Is it going to do too much or too little this year, having now resolved to raise interest rates several times in 2022? And it's great to have a conversation with Bill Dudley about these things, former chief economist for Goldman Sachs and former president of the New York Federal Reserve, now a senior advisor to Bloomberg Economics and Bloomberg Opinion columnist. Bill, if we just step back briefly, I mean, there's a lot to talk about, but if we think about the Fed's handling of the past 2 years of the pandemic, did they win the war but lose the peace? You have a lot of people in the peanut gallery now critiquing their view all through last year that inflation was going to be transitory. I think Mohammed Al-Aryan has called it probably the worst inflation call in the history of the Federal Reserve. Was it?
Well, I think they did a great job at the early stages of the pandemic in terms of their interventions to restore market function, ease financial conditions, push interest rates to zero. So I give them, you know, A plus, you know, back in April 2020. But since then, I think they've made a number of errors. And some of the errors are related to how they implement monetary policy. And some of the errors are just bad forecasting. On the monetary policy implementation side, they operationalized their 2% average inflation targeting regime by essentially tying their hands and saying, we cannot lift off, we cannot raise short-term rates until three conditions are satisfied. Inflation at 2%, expected to be above 2% for some time in the future. And we've also have to achieve our estimate of maximum sustainable employment. So what that meant was the Fed was going to have policy extremely easy, even as the economy reached full employment. So there's going to be a big gap between where the Fed needed to be versus where the Fed was. Completely self-induced error on their part. The second thing that was self-induced is they were so worried about a taper tantrum that they were very slow to actually taper the rate of asset purchases. So we've ended up in this odd situation today where everyone's talking about Fed tightening, but the Fed, even as we speak, is still buying assets, adding accommodation. The other two errors they made, I think, are hard, you know, I would give them less grief about because they're forecasting errors. The first forecasting error, which was significant, was that the inflation shock turned out to be much bigger and lasted much longer than they were anticipating. Nobody was expecting at the beginning of 2020 that we were going to see 7% CPI inflation by the end of 2021. And so that was a surprise to them. The supply chain disruption just lasted longer than they expected. The second surprise, and it wasn't all completely a bad surprise, is that the labor market tightened much faster than they expected. As you went through 2020 and the first part of 2021, Fed officials were focused on the shortfall of employment relative to where it was in February 2020. And he pointed to the fact that there were still a lot of jobs short from where we were in February 2020. Well, that's still the case today. We're still 3 million jobs short of where we were in February 2020. But that ignored the fact that there were a lot of people that left the labor force, as Anna pointed out. The labor force participation rate did not come back like the Fed expected. There were retirements. There are people that didn't want to work because of COVID risk. There are people who were still sick because of COVID, long COVID. And all those things have made the labor market tighten much faster than what the Fed expect. Now, it'd be fine if the labor market tightened faster than the Fed expected and the Fed responded by tightening monetary policy. But we're in a situation today where the labor market is very, very, very tight and monetary policy is still extraordinarily easy. So the Fed is late. They're trying to catch up and they'll start to catch up in March when they tighten at the March FOMC meeting.
So what's the road from here? Do you think the Fed's going to end up having to raise interest rates much more than people currently expect?
Yeah, I think they are going to have to do more than people expect because, you know, if you look at the Federal Reserve's forecast, it's an incredibly benign forecast. If you look at their forecast 2022, 23, 24 in the summary of economic projections, what they show is that inflation is going to magically melt away 2.6% this year, 2.3% next year, 2.1% in 2024. The federal funds rate's not going to go very high, 2.1% by the end of 2024. And the unemployment rate's going to, even as the unemployment rate is persistently below beyond full employment. So it's not obvious how the Fed forecast works. Why does inflation fall if the economy is operating below beyond full employment for 3 years and monetary policy never gets to a tight setting? So I think the Fed hasn't really, you know, they've bitten the bullet partly in the sense that they've admitted that they're behind the curve and so they're speeding up the pace of removing monetary policy accommodation. But they haven't gotten to the place where they actually recognize that they have to actually make monetary policy tight. And I think the last couple of weeks, our market's starting to come to the conclusion that monetary policy at some point in this cycle is going to have to be tight. It's not there yet, but we're moving in that direction.
And just to continue that thought, I mean, some are suggesting that in order to indicate that it's taking inflation more seriously, the Fed could go for a half a percentage point increase the first time they raise interest rates, rather than this very gradual path people are expecting of a quarter of a percentage point each time. Do you think that's something they should be thinking about?
Well, I'm certainly worth thinking about it, but I'd be very surprised if they did that. I mean, this Fed has tried to be very predictable, you know, in terms of how they communicate and how they act following their communication. So you know, a 50 basis point rate hike, which certainly, you know, you could argue it's appropriate, would be a huge shock to markets. And I think it goes very much against, you know, everything that Powell has told us over the last 18 months. So I think it'd be a huge surprise. And I'd be very surprised if they actually do that.
I'm smiling because I'm remembering, I think it was it Paul Volcker in the early 80s who just decided on a Sunday night to raise interest rates by 2 percentage points and to hell with the markets or what they were expecting. You just can't imagine a Fed chair doing that these days.
The good news, Stephanie, on that is that the markets still have quite a bit of confidence in the Fed. If, you know, we have a tight labor market, we have higher wages, but inflation expectations are still pretty well anchored. And I think if inflation expectations were to become unanchored, that would be a sign that the markets were losing confidence in the Fed. And that's what I think would push the Fed into having to be more aggressive.
Well, Bill, we're going to run out of time, but I think there is one big question I was interested in your answer to. You have to bet that by the end of this year, the chances are policymakers will either have done too much to tame inflation or too little. And we've had many years where the assumption has been that you should err on the side of having policy be too loose rather than too tight, that the risks of not giving enough support for the economy were much greater than the risks of doing too much. Has that changed? Are we now looking at a situation where the Fed should be more concerned about not doing enough to tame inflation?
Well, I think that's absolutely correct, because last cycle, inflation was too low for most of the cycle. So the Federal Reserve could actually try to see how tight they could make the labor market without any really big risk of that as a consequence. This time we're starting from a point that inflation is too high. It's above what the Fed's objective is, and the labor market's already very, very tight. So I think using the last economic cycle as a template for this cycle, I think is a very, very poor choice. This cycle is very different in terms of where we're starting, in terms of inflation and the unemployment rate. And it's also a very different cycle in where we're starting in terms of household balance sheets. Household balance sheets, debt service costs are really low. Households have a lot of savings. Last cycle, we had lots of damage caused by the great financial crisis. So people who are using the last cycle as a template for this cycle, I think, are going to be disappointed.
Thanks very much for that, Bill Dudley. Now, we're not trying to cover everything in this webinar, everything that's going on in the global economy. We're just trying to zero in on some of the key risks that people are thinking about. And I think top of that list is China. So we're going to hear now from our chief global economist, frequent participant on Stephanomics, Tom Orlig, who also spent 11 years in Beijing and has written 2 books about the Chinese economy. Tom.
Thanks, Stephanie. So if we were having this conversation a year or so ago, there would be a pretty positive story to tell about how China had weathered the COVID storm. From where we are at the start of 22, though, there's some pretty significant risks and obstacles which China now faces, in particular, the Evergrande property slump. It's difficult to disagree with Beijing's strategy here. The property sector is overbuilt and overleveraged, and the entire rickety structure rests on a foundation of moral hazard. And Evergrande, in many ways, is the poster child for those problems. So allowing Evergrande to default and go into restructuring absolutely makes sense. The trouble is that with so many other developers in a similar position to Evergrande in terms of their leverage levels, and with property such an important driver of growth across the economy as a whole, even making that modest down payment on addressing the problem of moral hazard comes with some significant costs attached. As confidence in the sector ebbs away, we're seeing sales and investment weaken. And with property directly and indirectly driving about a quarter of China's overall GDP, that has to come at a cost to growth in the year ahead. The second big risk for China looking forward is what happens when the Omicron variant hits. Now, in 2020, China's COVID strategy was brutally effective. It saved lives, it provided the basis for a V-shaped recovery in GDP. But now they face some new and some difficult questions. In particular, what's the end game for their strategy? That strategy works in terms of keeping the population healthy, but it does come at a cost to growth. Lockdowns hit consumption. We saw that last summer when retail sales stumbled in the face of the Delta outbreak. And as we heard from Anna, in a nightmare scenario with widespread lockdowns, factories and ports closing down, we could see China contributing to the global supply crunch. We don't think that's the baseline scenario. China so far has done a good job at keeping production on track. But certainly, as cases in the Xi'an outbreak rise, it's a risk which is worth keeping in mind. So if we pull those pieces together, our base case for China's GDP this year is actually pretty positive. We think growth could come in above 5% for the year. But risks to that outlook from Evergrande, from the Omicron variant, are firmly to the downside, and a much lower number is certainly possible. With all that in mind, it's no surprise that the People's Bank of China has already moved towards stimulus.
So just coming back to the question of the property risk, obviously, everyone's had to learn the name Evergrande and even think about how to pronounce it. Apart from these monetary policy tools you've talked about, are there any specific policies that China has for managing the boom and bust of the property cycle and maybe getting to a situation where they're not so dependent on property for driving the growth of the economy?
Yes, you're completely right, Stephanie, and I should have gone with the more flamboyant Evergrande pronunciation, which I hear in Hong Kong and is a little bit more fun. So what China can't do is control the kind of the fundamental problem in the property sector. They can't get away from the problem that there's massive overbuilding, that the country is littered with ghost towns, that developers have borrowed too much money. That sort of fundamental characteristics of the problem they can't change. What they do have, though, is a very refined and granular set of tools that they can try and use to manage the problem down. So they don't just set interest rates, they set interest rates for mortgages specifically, and they can set them at different rates for first-time buyers and second-time buyers and third-time buyers. They can change down payment requirements city by city and change down payment requirements for first-time buyers and second-time buyers and third-time buyers. They can open the credit taps for real estate developers in different ways for different categories of developer. So they can't magically make the problem go away. But what they've done over the last decade is develop this rather precise set of tools for managing it. And I expect we'll see those coming into play in the months ahead.
And finally, Tom, Xi Jinping, we've seen him become more and more powerful as a Chinese president, leader of the Chinese Communist Party. And he's also, through that, increased the hold of the party over the economy. We're now seeing him seek a third term as leader, maybe even leadership for life, as some are calling it. What are the economic implications of that?
Yes. So Xi has been moving the sort of pieces into place to ensure that he can have a third term as president and as general secretary of the Communist Party. And that process will sort of reach its end game at the end of this year, and very likely Xi will succeed. So there are some short-term and some long-term implications of that. The short-term implication is, well, China, in the best of times, has very little tolerance for bad news. In the run-up to big political events, and appointing Xi for a third term as president will be a big political event, they have zero tolerance for bad news. So that's a reason to think that they will stay very strict in terms of containing the spread of COVID. And it's also a reason to think, I think, that in the final analysis, they're not going to allow property to trigger a collapse in the economy this year. Looking longer term, well, one of the big successes of Deng Xiaoping, China's great reformer, was getting in place a process for orderly leadership succession. An orderly handover from Deng to Jiang Zemin, from Jiang Zemin to Hu Jintao, and from Hu Jintao to Xi Jinping. if Xi Jinping succeeds in getting a third term as China's leader, well, there's going to be some new questions about that orderly succession process. The wheels are not going to come off the wagon of Chinese governance immediately, but I think we'd be looking for problems in that area in the years ahead.
Tom Orlick, thank you very much. So that was a big dollop of economic intelligence from Bloomberg. Next week, we might let some non-Bloomberg folks get a word in. Finally, David Hood from Bloomberg Tax has this sorry tale of the overburdened Inland Revenue Service switchboard and very long-suffering accountants, or CPAs, who are finding they can't ever, ever get through.
Welcome to the Internal Revenue Service. You can also visit us at www.irs.gov.
Got a tax question? Who are you going to call?
To continue in English.
Not the IRS. In fact, anyone but the IRS. Unless, of course, you or your CPA have time to wait, wait, wait. And wait some more on hold. That's the opinion of frustrated taxpayers, tax preparers, the White House, and even the agency itself. During peak tax season, your CPA can expect to be on hold for 90 minutes or more, even if they call what some pros call the bat phone, a dedicated line to the IRS for CPAs to call when they have a complicated question.
The phones have been particularly difficult when certain big things have happened. For instance, if you needed to get a hold of the IRS to deal with a certain penalty notice around the same time that something was happening with the stimulus payments, that would be particularly difficult.
That was Rochelle Hotz, a principal in Crowe's Washington National Tax Office. Many big things happened in 2021, like more stimulus payments, advanced child tax credit checks, and, of course, the pandemic. The free market did come up with an idea to help tax professionals. They can, for a fee, hire robots to wait in line for them. A startup called NQ Inc. offers a service starting around $100 a month that makes robocalls to the agency's special so-called bat phone, waits on hold, and then, when it makes a connection, puts the client through to an IRS agent. Or your CPA can just call, wait on hold, maybe get some lunch, and come back. And of course, stay on hold. Thankfully, the agency recognizes these problems and has a strategy in the works to fix them. The IRS has plans to ramp up hiring for its call centers around the country, which have felt the same labor shortage crunch as other businesses. The agency is also rolling out natural language service bots to help taxpayers set up payment plans and get help quicker. However, these plans hinge on the country's most notoriously unreliable group. That's right, Congress. If Congress can pass President Joe Biden's Build Back Better bill, it will hand the IRS $8 billion a year for the next 10 years. That, tax pros say, will go a long way to help hire more people, open more call centers, and roll out better technology. But a bill isn't a magic wand. The agency would still need to recruit, hire, train, and retain more folks, update IT systems, and tell the public phone lines are open for business. If everything goes perfectly, we're still some years off from solving these problems, said Bill Smith, National Director of Tax Technical Services for CBIZ MHM.
It would go a long way towards helping that situation get a lot better. Is it going to happen immediately, even with the funding? I don't think so.
From Bloomberg Tax, I'm David Hood.
That's it for this week. Join me for another Stephanomics next week. And if you want more on the global economy, do follow @economics on Twitter. Also, rate this podcast if you like it. This episode was produced by Magnus Henriksen, with special thanks to Anna Wong, Bill Dudley, Tom Orlick, and David Hood. Mike Sasso is executive producer of Stephanomics, and the head of Bloomberg Podcast is Francesca Levy.